I want you to think about a feeling you've probably had at some point this week.
Oh, I think I know where this is going.
Yeah, I mean, have you ever looked around maybe at your workplace or, watching the news about your local government or even just scrolling through your favorite social media platform?
Right.
And you just get this overwhelming sense that a tiny, like, microscopic group of people is somehow dictating all the rules for everyone else.
It is a very, very visceral frustration. I think almost everyone shares it.
Exactly. It's this weird, persistent paradox in our lives. We are constantly told that the majority holds the power in our society, but our lived experience constantly tells us the exact opposite.
Yeah, and historically, that frustration, it often gets channeled into this assumption that there must be some, shadowy, omnipotent conspiracy pulling the strings behind a velvet curtain.
Right, like a movie villain. But today we're going to look behind that curtain, and what we have for you is honestly so much more fascinating than a conspiracy theory.
Oh, absolutely.
So we're looking at a brilliant piece of research from August 2026. It was jointly published by the American newspaper and American TV, and it's titled Why Organized Minorities Rule Unorganized Majorities.
It's a dense read, but it's incredible.
It really is. It treats this dynamic not as some secret society thriller, but essentially as an engineering problem.
Yeah, the report draws on classical sociology, political science, and institutional analysis to explain that minority rule isn't about magic. And it isn't a glitch in the system either.
It's a feature, not a bug.
Exactly. It is the predictable outcome of structural mechanics.
So the mission of our deep dive today is to decode those hidden mechanics. We are going to look at the brutal, undeniable math of organization.
I love that phrasing, the math of organization.
Right. The goal here is to give you a shortcut to understanding how power is actually maintained in the real world. And more importantly, we're going to explore how a dispersed majority can actually fight back, how to build countervailing power.
Because understanding the machinery of minority rule, I mean, that is the first absolute prerequisite to dismantling it, or at least balancing the scales. You can't fix an engine if you don't know how the pistons work.
Okay, let's unpack this. The central premise of this research relies on a massive asymmetry, but it's not an asymmetry of numbers.
No, not at all.
Right. To understand why sheer numbers do not guarantee control, we first have to look at the mathematical reality of how power is actually generated. The core argument here is that coordination defeats arithmetic, like every single time.
Yeah. 10 people acting with a shared plan, shared communication, and defined roles, they will consistently outmaneuver 10,000 people acting as isolated individuals.
That's wild to think about.
It is, but the math of power just heavily discounts the unorganized.
I was actually thinking about an analogy for this. Picture a massive sports stadium.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
You have 100,000 fans sitting in the stands, and they represent the unorganized majority. Down on the field, you have just 11 players representing the organized minority.
Oh, I like this.
Now, if you just look at mass, volume, and potential energy, the fans have an overwhelming advantage. I mean, if all 100,000 fans decided to rush the field at the exact same moment, the players wouldn't stand a chance.
They'd be totally crushed.
Exactly. But the fans are just a crowd. The 11 players, on the other hand, they have a playbook, they have highly specialized positions, they have a coach calling plays, and they have headsets for instant communication.
What's fascinating here is that the report formalizes that exact dynamic into a concept it calls the power multiplier.
Right, it's an actual equation.
Yeah, it frames the power of an organized minority as an equation. It says power equals concentrated interests multiplied by organizational capacity, multiplied by resources, information, institutional control, and legitimacy.
That's a lot of variables.
It is, but the key thing, well, because it's a multiplier and not just a checklist you add together, it means a zero anywhere zeros out the whole product.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. So if a ruling group has billions of dollars in resources and total institutional capture, but their legitimacy drops to absolute zero, the whole regime collapses.
Wait, have we actually seen that happen historically?
There we have. I mean, think about sudden regime collapses like the fall of the Eastern Bloc.
Right.
Those state structures had massive military resources, they had total control over institutions, but their legitimacy hit zero.
Because nobody believed in them anymore.
Exactly. When people absolutely refuse to believe you have the right to rule, you have to spend all your resources on physical coercion. And coercion is incredibly expensive.
I guess you can't just arrest everybody.
You really can't. It eventually bankrupts your organizational capacity,
yeah.
and the whole multiplier goes to zero. But when these factors work together, they reinforce each other.
Like a positive feedback loop.
Right. Your resources buy you better information. Your information secures institutional control, and institutional control lets you write the rules to generate even more resources.
Okay, I have to push back on the resource variable, though. Going back to our stadium analogy, the 100,000 fans in the stands possess vastly more resources in the aggregate.
Sure, in total numbers, yes.
Right. If you pool all the money, all the labor, and all the votes of the majority, it just completely dwarfs what the minority has. Why doesn't that latent power just overwhelm the minority automatically?
Well, latent power is the key phrase there. The report relies heavily on the theories of the economist Mancur Olson to explain this.
Okay, what does he say?
He explains why those aggregate resources are entirely useless if they aren't activated and pooled. Olson points out a really harsh reality, which is that concentrated interests organize much faster and much more efficiently than diffuse interests.
Because the payoff for the small group is highly concentrated.
Exactly.
Like, if five corporate executives want a specific regulatory loophole, the per-member payoff could be millions of dollars. It makes complete economic sense for them to hire lawyers, hire lobbyists, and spend months coordinating.
Yeah, and exactly the opposite is true for the majority. For the millions of citizens who might each lose, say, 50 cents because of that loophole, the coordination costs are simply too high.
Right. It costs you more in time and energy to fight the loophole than you would lose if it passes.
You got it. And people have lives.
Yeah. The text really dives into livelihood pressures. I mean, if you are a single parent working double shifts, or even just someone exhausted after a 40-hour work week, you do not have the bandwidth to go argue at a zoning board meeting on a Tuesday night.
No one wants to do that.
Right. But the real estate developer trying to change the zoning laws, however, is paying a legal team to be there. It's their literal job.
Which leads to the ultimate hurdle Olson identified, which is the free rider problem.
Oh, this is a big one.
It really is. Even if a citizen deeply cares about an issue and, you know, they actually have the time to fight it, it is completely rational for them to just sit back and hope their neighbor does the exhausting work of organizing.
Because they get the reward anyway.
Right. They know they will still reap the benefits of a better zoning law or a cleaner environment if the neighbor succeeds. So the majority is structurally incentivized to remain dispersed.
That is so frustrating. So if we understand the ingredients of power and why the majority struggles to organize, how does the small group actually maintain their grip over decades?
That's the real question.
Yeah, because as you mentioned, they can't rely on brute force forever. The report brings in a toolkit of classic sociological theorists to explain this structural lock-in, doesn't it?
It does. And these theorists are crucial because they explain how minority rule embeds itself into the very fabric of society. It moves from a temporary advantage to like a permanent architecture.
The one that really caught my eye was Robert Meikle's and his Iron Law of Oligarchy. I have to say, this part is almost depressing.
It's a tough pill to swallow, yeah.
He argues that every organization, even a grassroots movement founded on total democratic equality, inevitably becomes an oligarchy. It made me think of a neighborhood homeowners association.
Oh, the dreaded HOA. Perfect example.
Right. It starts as a group of neighbors organizing a summer block party, and 5 years later, a three-person committee is walking around measuring your grass with a ruler and issuing fines.
That HOA is the Iron Law in action. But Michels argues this isn't because people are inherently malicious. It's just because survival as an organization requires specialization.
Somebody has to do the boring stuff.
Exactly. Someone has to balance the ledger, someone has to manage the email lists, and someone has to navigate the legal bylaws.
And the people who do that mundane work inevitably gain asymmetric control over information.
Yes. Over time, those leaders become specialists in running the machine. The ordinary members, the rest of the neighborhood in your HOA example, they just can't keep up with the day-to-day procedural knowledge.
So power just naturally concentrates at the top.
It does. And inevitably, leadership begins to conflate the survival of the organization with their own continuation in power.
Wow. So Michels explains how a movement gets hijacked from the inside by its own bureaucrats. But how does that tiny leadership group stop the outside majority from just revolting? Because if the HOA gets too tyrannical, eventually the neighborhood brings pitchforks. This is where the text brings in Antonio Gramsci and Gaetano Mosca, right?
It is. Because a ruling minority cannot survive if it constantly has to fight the majority. Gramsci and Mosca explain that durable rule relies on building deep psychological consent.
Consent, okay.
Yeah, you need what Mosca called a political formula. It's basically a widely accepted set of beliefs that justifies your authority to rule.
Like historical monarchs claiming the divine right of kings, or maybe modern elites claiming they rule because they have the best technocratic expertise.
Right, or because the free market naturally selected them as the most capable.
Got it. And Gramsci's concept of hegemony takes that even further, doesn't it?
It does. Hegemony is achieved when a particular group's specific interests are successfully framed as common sense, or like a universal good.
So people don't even question it?
Exactly. It's when the majority looks at a highly engineered, unequal system and says, well, I mean, this is just the natural order of things. The report notes that cultural institutions, schools, and media are the infrastructure that organizes this common sense.
Because it is infinitely cheaper to rule through manufactured legitimacy than through police forces.
100%.
So if every distinct sector, the military, the economy, the media, develops its own elite using these formulas, do they ever bump into each other?
Oh, constantly.
The report uses C. Wright Mills' concept of the power elite to explain how this works at the highest levels, right? And it's very careful to emphasize that this is not a coordinated conspiracy in a smoke-filled room.
Right. No smoke-filled rooms here.
Yeah.
Mills focuses on the mechanics of institutional interlock. The people who occupy the command posts of our major institutions form a shared elite ecology.
So they sort of inhabit the same world.
Yeah, they attend the same elite universities, they sit on the same philanthropic boards, their children move in the same social circles, and they constantly rotate between government advisory roles and corporate boardrooms.
And because they share those career pathways, they develop identical assumptions about how the world should operate. But I love that the report highlights the friction here.
Yeah, it's not a monolith.
Right. This elite ecology features intense rivalries. Like, the tech elite might fight viciously with the political elite over a specific regulation.
Oh, for sure. They fight over who gets the biggest piece of the pie, but they collaborate on the basic rules of the game. They mutually agree on how the pie is baked.
That's a great way to put it.
And they absolutely agree that the unorganized majority outside the bakery shouldn't get a say in the recipe. The system is highly competitive, but the competition is restricted to a very small, exclusive arena.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Because power relies on this institutional interlock, we have to look at the specific arenas governing us today.
Yeah, this is the modern application.
The report analyzes traditional state houses and bureaucracies, sure, but it pivots to an arena it treats as entirely unique. Something dictating the daily life of every person listening right now, which is digital platforms.
Yeah. The digital platform is the ultimate hyper-accelerated manifestation of minority rule.
How so?
Well, the report breaks down how a microscopic team, a handful of executives, lead engineers, and maybe a trust and policy team, acts as the organized minority governing billions of people.
Billions, with a B.
Right. And their resources aren't traditional capital or physical weapons. Their resources are algorithms, massive troves of behavioral data, and network effects.
The rules of the game here are completely foreign compared to traditional civics. I mean, if I'm dealing with a traditional government, even an annoyingly bureaucratic one, I can physically go to a library or a government website and read the laws.
You can see the text, yeah.
The jurisdiction is clear. But platform rules are embedded directly into the code, and that code is a black box.
I imagine it like playing a complex board game against someone, but while you are taking your turn, your opponent is secretly rewriting the rules on the back of the cards.
That's exactly what it's like.
And they can update those rules instantaneously for every player on Earth.
The speed and scale are what make it truly unprecedented. Look, in a traditional state house, enforcement requires friction.
What do you mean by friction?
If a government wants to silence a citizen, they have to deploy police, navigate courts, and deal with public due process.
Mm-hmm.
A digital platform. They can just tweak an algorithmic weight by a fraction of a percent, and suddenly your business, your publication, or your social movement is rendered completely invisible.
Just wiped off the map.
Yeah. It is automated, immediate enforcement without a single human being ever touching you. It's basically invisible legislation. How on earth do you hold that kind of power accountable? I mean, if we don't want to just smash the servers with a hammer because we actually like the convenience and connectivity of the technology, How do we democratize a black box?
The text is clear that democratic accountability here doesn't mean destroying technical expertise. We need brilliant engineers to build these systems.
Sure.
The danger is when technical expertise morphs into unreviewable public authority. Platforms essentially act as sovereign governments over our digital lives, so the report suggests structural architectural restraints.
It mentions data portability, which I think is a massive concept. Can you explain how that works as a restraint on power?
So right now, platforms maintain power through network effects. You can't leave platform A because all your friends and business contacts are trapped there.
Right, you're a hostage.
Exactly. Data portability means legally requiring platforms to let you take your entire social graph, your connections, your history, and seamlessly move it to a competitor.
Like how you can take your cell phone number to a new carrier.
Yes, exactly. It breaks the hostage situation.
The report also heavily emphasizes independent research access and interoperability.
Right.
So interoperability meaning I can be on platform B but still send a message to my friend on platform A. And research access means third-party auditors can actually look under the hood of the algorithm.
Which is huge.
Yeah, to verify if the platform is prioritizing outrage or suppressing specific voices rather than just taking the CEO's word for it.
It's all about introducing friction and transparency into a system that currently operates with total impunity.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? I mean, with all these structural advantages aggressively stacked in favor of the minority, from the iron law of oligarchy to algorithmic black boxes, what hope does the unorganized majority actually have?
It sounds bleak, I know.
It really does. How do you flip the script?
Well, the report doesn't leave us at a dead end. It provides a strategic roadmap for what it calls countervailing power.
Okay.
And perhaps the most vital lesson is identifying what actually doesn't work. The report strongly warns against relying on spontaneous episodic outrage.
The protest illusion. We see this all the time.
Oh, constantly.
A huge injustice occurs. Millions of people organically organize a massive march in the streets for a weekend. It completely dominates the news cycle. The energy feels unstoppable. And then a month later, absolutely nothing has changed.
Right, because an organized minority knows how to weather a storm. They understand that without a permanent institutional structure, the majority will eventually run out of funds, run out of energy, and have to go back to their jobs.
As livelihood pressures kick back in.
Exactly. The minority just waits for the media cycle to turn. They offer a few cosmetic, non-binding concessions, and they wait for the crowd to disperse. The antidote to an organized minority is never an unorganized mass. The antidote is organized pluralism.
You have to build the machine. You have to write your own playbook and get on the field. The text outlines a specific blueprint for how a dispersed majority can build lasting power. Let's debate these conditions because they are incredibly actionable. First, they say you need a limited set of concrete goals. Broad moral language is great for a protest sign, but you can't negotiate a contract with a slogan.
Exactly. You have to translate systemic grievance into specific, measurable, and achievable objectives.
The second condition is collective financing, like dues or a small donor system. But I have to ask, building an organization is expensive and slow.
It is.
So if a local movement is trying to challenge a massive corporate monopoly, wouldn't it just be faster and more efficient to find a sympathetic billionaire patron to fund the resistance?
I mean, it would be faster, sure, but it violates the core mechanics of power we've been discussing.
How so?
If your entire movement relies on the goodwill of one wealthy patron, you haven't built a democratic movement. You've just become that patron's hobby.
Oh, wow.
The moment your concrete goals diverge from their personal interests, the funding vanishes. Collective financing ensures the organization remains accountable only to its members.
That makes a lot of sense. Third is independent communication networks. The irony of organizing a massive protest against tech monopolies using the very platforms owned by those monopolies shouldn't be lost on anyone.
It's a huge blind spot.
Yeah, you need communication channels the ruling minority cannot algorithmically suppress. And fourth, the blueprint demands acquiring institutional footholds.
This is the transition from a movement to an institution. You need legal standing to sue in courts. You need collective bargaining rights recognized by law. You need to win seats on local administrative boards.
You have to physically embed your countervailing power into the institutional architecture of the state.
Exactly.
But wait, I'm looking at this blueprint and it feels like a massive catch-22. We just established that the unorganized majority is exhausted, dealing with livelihood pressures, and structurally trapped by the free rider problem. Telling them to just build an independent, collectively financed organization with legal standing feels like a paradox. If they had the time and resources to do that, they wouldn't be the unorganized majority. How do you bridge that gap?
It is the central paradox of democratic organizing, and the report acknowledges this friction. The answer isn't that every single citizen needs to build a new organization from scratch.
Okay, good.
The answer is joining and revitalizing existing organizations. You know, unions, civic groups, local political chapters. But your point brings us right back to Robert Michaels.
The iron law of oligarchy.
Yes. If you join an existing organization, how do you know you aren't just joining an oligarchy in disguise?
Exactly. How can the listener tell if a nonprofit or a political group they want to dedicate their scarce time to is genuinely democratic, or if it's just a closed loop using progressive buzzwords to mask the founder's power?
The report provides a diagnostic checklist. You ignore their mission statement and you look purely at their mechanics.
Okay, what's on the checklist?
First, do they disclose their finances and their strategic evidence openly to the membership?
So if the ledger is a secret, run.
Pretty much. Second, how does the organization handle failure? Can errors be openly acknowledged and policies corrected without destroying the leadership?
Why does that matter so much?
Because in a closed oligarchy, admitting a mistake threatens the underlying political formula, so leadership just covers it up. In a genuinely democratic organization, course correction is routine and public.
Got it. And the ultimate test is leadership turnover, right?
Yes. Is turnover planned, institutionalized, and genuinely competitive? Or does the founder view the organization as their personal property? Yeah. If there is no mechanism to peacefully and routinely replace the leadership, you are participating in an oligarchy.
It takes all the emotion out of politics and asks you to look strictly at the plumbing.
It really does.
Which brings us to the core synthesis of this entire deep dive. If there's one overarching realization you take away from this research, it's this. Durable domination is always organized. Which means durable freedom must also be meticulously organized. This isn't a call to burn down all institutions or destroy the concept of elites. Complex modern societies need leaders, they require technical experts, and they need administration.
We can't just operate in chaos.
Right. The goal of countervailing power is to make sure that leadership remains a public trust, constantly checked and balanced, rather than a private possession.
Achieving that requires constant structural vigilance. And the report leaves us with a final, somewhat provocative philosophical question. It draws on the sociologist Vilfredo Pareto.
Oh, I've heard of him.
Yeah, Pareto had a concept called elite circulation. He argued that human history is essentially just a graveyard of aristocracies.
That is a dark image.
It is. He says elites rise, they establish their political formula, they rule, they inevitably decay, and they are replaced by a new elite.
So when we look back at massive historical revolutions or sweeping electoral waves that promise to finally return power to the people, or even massive technological disruptions that promise to democratize information.
The question you have to ask yourself is this. Are we actually seeing the unorganized majority finally taking power? Or are we just watching a stagnant, decaying, organized minority being outmaneuvered and replaced by a brand new, highly efficient organized minority?
Wow.
Right. Is true sustained democracy even mathematically possible over the long term? Or is human history just an endless, complex game of musical chairs among different factions of elites?
That is a lingering, slightly unsettling thought to chew on. But it's exactly why decoding these mechanics matters. The next time you find yourself sitting in the stands of that massive stadium feeling overwhelmed by the rules of the game, don't just passively boo the referee.
No, you have to look closer.
Exactly. Look closely at the players on the field. Look at your workplace, your local government, your digital networks, and ask yourself, who actually wrote this playbook? Who controls the agenda before the vote even happens? And most importantly, who are you going to organize with to get off the bleachers and get onto the field?